Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Recent failures involving Tesla's autopilot system have people wondering about the future of self-driving vehicles. We look at where things stand with automakers, regulators, and public opinion coming up. First, the show must go on. That's been the attitude of workplaces and employers for more than a year as we've gone through a worldwide health crisis. Many people have worked the whole time with little to no change in workload and productivity. But now that summer's here, a summer when mask orders are lifting in many parts of the state, vaccinations are making some people feel safer, and outdoor dining and gathering seeing a sharp uptick, I mean, it's hard not to want to slow down on the work, maybe just a little. So do you want to ease up? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Would you like to see some kind of summer break from work after making it through 15 months of isolation? The number is 800-642-1234. You can call us or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Charlie Warzel writes Galaxy Brain, a newsletter about tech and culture. He previously wrote for the New York Times Opinion, and he last month wrote a newsletter titled It's Time for a Summer Slowdown. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote about how in any year, even setting COVID aside, we see a pattern in productivity levels as employees transition to summer months. What does that look like?
Well, every summer there's this. I would say it's a bit of a manufactured panic or concern that usually only shows up in a lot of the business trade papers or things like that, magazines like Inc. or Forbes, and it's about this idea of a summer slowdown and that people are going to take their foot off the gas, put their foot on the brakes a little bit and go, you know, spend time with family, take some vacations, and that. You know, a large part of the workforce is going to do that altogether. And this is framed a lot of times as worrisome, right, for the business. It's a productivity halt. It's concerning in some way. And this year we haven't heard quite as much about it, but we're watching a lot of, you know, corporations say, let's not take our eye off the ball here. It's time to get back to work. And that really sort of means coming back to the office as more and more spaces are opening up. And so you're sort of seeing this fear of a summer slowdown this time be ameliorated by companies by wanting to kind of bring them back in.
And I imagine some employees are sitting here thinking, read the room. Like, it's been a really hard time. And to tell us not to take our foot off the gas now when it's getting beautiful outside and when it's been really, really tough. How is that landing with employees? How did they see the summer slowdown?
Well, it's landing terribly, and it's actually the reason why I wrote the piece that I wrote, which was actually arguing for us to not just, you know, tolerate a summer slowdown but embrace it. But what we're seeing is somewhat of the opposite, right? Employers are a little worried, and employees are just not having it. They're frustrated. There's a lot of resentment that's been built up, as you said in the intro there, of, you know, laboring through 15, 16 months of complete isolation while homeschooling kids, while hiding from a deadly virus. And they have shown in almost every industry that not only are they just getting the job done, productivity is you know, where it was before. It's in some cases it's higher. And so I think there's this feeling that that workers are owed something for kind of, you know, bucking up and really, you know, following through during this difficult time.
What about employers who say, you know, yes, employees have really stepped up to the plate, but so have we. We've changed our processes. We've helped people work from places that they felt better. Do businesses or people running those businesses think that, you know, they've also contributed enough and they've sacrificed enough and now it's time to that sort of back to normal that you mentioned?
I think everyone has sacrificed, and this isn't to say that if you run a company that you haven't had extraordinary difficulties too, if you're a manager in charge of people. But I think it misses the larger picture. And I think it's that idea of normal that you just mentioned that is really tricky. It's sticky for a lot of people. You know, the pandemic was a lot of things, but one of the things that it was an opportunity for people to reflect on both, you know, the very abnormal state of affairs over the last 16 months, but also, you know, what was quote unquote normal beforehand. And I think there's a lot of reexamination that's gone on in many people's lives, and many people saying to themselves, you know, normal wasn't actually so good for me. Normal was actually very stressful. It was very hard. I was burned out then too. And I think a lot of people are seeing this as an inflection point. This is a point in time where there's a little bit of leverage to say, hey, we don't have to do things the way that we always did them just because. And so I think employers who are just, you know, kind of looking to go back to that safe status quo, I think they're missing what employees are seeing, which is that this is a flexible kind of plastic moment here to reimagine the way that we do business and try to find a way to make it, you know, more livable for everyone.
Charlie Warzel writes a newsletter about tech and culture. He argues it's time to intentionally slow down for the summer. What do you think? 800-642-1234. You can join the conversation on the phone. If you're an employer, do you notice a slight slowdown in productivity in your workers in the warmer months? How do you account for that, or do you embrace it? Have you given thought to more vacation time or occasional Fridays off this summer if you're working? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Charlie, I want to talk about time off and how employers have handled work-life balance. In your piece, you mentioned this phrase, feel free to take some time if you need it. There's a lot there in those few words.
Sure. This is something that my co-author and my partner on this forthcoming book that we have about the future of work and remote work. This is her phrase, and this, you know, feel free to take some time if you need it, is essentially, as she puts it, and as I agree, a bit of a trap, right? It is fundamentally a sorting question. She says, are you someone who needs to take that time, or are you someone who can, you know, just ignore that and work really hard? This idea that, you know, overwork is to some degree a virtue, and this feel free to take time if you need it is a cop out. It's this way that you know, organizations get to have it both ways. They get to pretend like they are on your side while also, you know, not really putting your foot down and telling you to actually take the time and not modeling that behavior. And that modeling of good, you know, work-life balance is something that executives and managers really need to perform in order to make everyone else feel comfortable with actually taking the time.
Explain then the difference between boundaries that are on the responsibility of the employee and what employers can do.
Absolutely. So, you know, the boundaries are a good way to think about this as a bit of a metaphor. Is a boundary is you know, it's a border on a map, right? When you cross the border over from where you guys are into you know, Minnesota, or, you know, if you go where I am in Montana into Wyoming, you know, you don't, it's sort of a malleable thing. But and that's a little bit what a lot of our boundaries are in work-life balance, right? It's sort of saying, hey, you know, this is, it's the take some time if you want it. But what is needed is something more structural, something like guardrails, right? Guardrails are not visible, you know, lines of demarcation. They are physical things. You hit the guardrail, you're going to bounce off. And that's what's needed in the workplace is structural systems that need to come into place to, you know, actually give people, you know, some help in their working lives. And so a good example of a guardrail there is mandated time that you have to take off. You know, a lot of employers give time off, and if it's not used, it just kind of recycles itself. It sets back to zero. And those types of systems are actually in place to make sure that they're not used as much. And so what's really needed is for businesses, for employers to actually rethink and try to figure out ways to, you know, force employees to look after themselves, because the way that things are set up now, you know, with focuses on competition and growth, a lot of times, you know, the businesses don't have time to look out for their employees in that way.
Charlie Warzel writes Galaxy Brain, a newsletter about tech and culture. I previously wrote for the New York Times Opinion. We're talking about the summer slowdown. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does the idea of a summer slowdown or a break appeal to you? What would you like to see companies do to support that? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. This conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Our guest says workers and companies should adjust their attitudes about taking more time off the clock in the summertime. We are talking about it here on Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is Charlie Warzel. He writes Galaxy Brain. It's a newsletter about tech and culture. And he recently wrote about the summer slowdown and worker productivity in the warmer months. And your calls are welcome here on the Ideas Network. You can use 800-642-1234. Maybe you're an employer or a manager. Have you considered giving employees more time off during the summer? Or how do you cope with a productivity slowdown? 800-642-1234. Still time for your call at that number. Charlie, we've talked on the past on this show about burnout, especially pandemic-related burnout and fatigue. What is your sense of how workers are feeling right now?
The sense that we've gotten, you know, reporting our book and then also just, you know, anecdotally having conversations with hundreds of people across the country right now, it's a pretty dire situation, honestly. People are, I think, really, really spread thin. They are, as I said earlier, there's a lot of resentment that is built up for having to, you know, just work through this very difficult period. And I think a lot of people, you know, processing, you know, pandemic-related trauma, mourning losses in their families, or just simply, you know, having to deal with not being able to really go and interact in public in the way that they wanted to for such a long period of time. All of that together has created a real disengagement. Global workplace surveys are showing that people are disengaged at record numbers at work. Very few people are reporting, you know, that they're positively engaged in their jobs. There's a lot of worker turnover that is happening even throughout the pandemic. And I think that people are just, they're spread very thin, and they're starting to question the way that things are done. We've seen a number of instances where companies have said they want to go back into the office this summer, and they're mandating that their employees go back in the office. And people are quitting on the spot, just saying no, thank you, and opting to go somewhere else. And I think that, you know, some of that too is for people who are lucky enough to have jobs throughout the pandemic. There was a lot of savings that people accumulated from not going out, or from also, you know, collecting stimulus benefits from the government. And so there's, you know, for the first time, a lot of people who have been in this precarious situation and also have that privilege of being a knowledge worker are saying, well, I have a little bit of freedom right now, and you know, I'm not going to just sit there and take this. And I think that that's something that a lot of companies are starting, you know, somewhat slowly to realize, which is that workers have a little bit of power right now that they didn't quite have about 18 months ago.
You posted about this on Twitter, and you asked people what people would like companies to do to give some workers a break this summer. What kinds of things did you hear?
Quite a bit. People were pretty creative about what they wanted for a summer slowdown. The biggest requests were, you know, more paid time off, higher salaries. Summer Fridays were very popular. But, you know, there's also this idea of, you know, again, these sort of these structural guardrails, which is, you know, strict encouragement of limited, you know, time off. There were, you know, requests for stipends for childcare because the school year is about to end for so many people. And, you know, they've been, you know, with their kids in their homes for, you know, the last almost 2 years. There are proposals for stipends for dinners so employees don't have to necessarily cook after a full day of work, allowances for apartment or house cleaning services, you know, sort of a rethinking of the standard perks. And then there's obviously, you know, bolstered mental health perks, things like that. Some of the interesting ones as it pertains to summer that I thought were sort of this a modified system in which most of the company tries to take 1 week off together. And that's to sort of eliminate this thing that happens when people go on vacation and the whole company's working without you and you come back to a huge stack of work and your reentry is really difficult. And it's this idea that maybe if we all take this time together, we can really, truly relax and not worry, you know, about work piling up around us or getting interrupted during our time off so we can truly recharge.
Charlie Warzel is our guest. He writes a newsletter about tech and culture. And we are taking your calls about the idea of productivity in the summer, especially this summer, but always, and how workers and their managers, their bosses see the difference. You're listening here on the Ideas Network. And we've got Ethel from Green Bay ready to join the conversation. Hi, Ethel.
Hi. Yes, my husband owned a business, and he believed that the employees should be very important people in the company and not just they just come in and work for you. And he always felt that what you give to them, you get from them. And so if he had issues that like certain things that he wanted to get some answers to, he would talk with his employees and see where they're coming from. And they really felt that he was then giving them some ownership in the company. And I think that's really important.
Ethel, thank you so much for talking about how your husband ran that business. And Charlie, what Ethel's getting at here is workplace culture.
Yeah, I think it's very key. Workplace culture is notoriously difficult to define. It's sort of one of those you know when you see it type things. But it is extremely important. And I would say that you know what Ethel pointed out there is something we've seen in a lot of our work and reporting, which is that in the long term, the decisions that might seem difficult or scary for a company, as long as they align with what the workers want, ultimately that's good for them in the long term. There's actually a lot of synergies between what's good for a company and what's good for workers, because you know you do want happy, productive workers. An unhappy worker is notoriously a more expensive worker, a lot of studies have shown. And so I think that this is something that when we're talking about, you know, whether to extend remote work to, you know, out past the pandemic or, you know, to experiment with more flexible schedules, the companies that are hesitant to do this often aren't seeing that it is actually in their long-term interest to have these very open conversations with employees and actually have them feel like they are true stakeholders and in charge of the direction of the company to some extent.
Thanks so much for the call, Ethel. We've got Owen in Wyawega on the line now. Hey, Owen.
Hey, Owen.
Yeah, hey. So, I mean, for me, this pandemic started, my workload increased by about 70%. Seemed like I picked up where a lot of other people had just left off, and there's a ton of available work out there. And, you know, that's what Republicans always say. Well, if you're not happy with the minimum wage job you have, you know, work 2-3 jobs. And I was able to do that. And now it seems like there's not any replacements coming back into the labor force. So there's still plenty of work available. So the idea of, I guess you'd have to be some sort of professional working in some sort of specific field. I know I got a lot of friends that are dentists and different, you know, type of, what's the word I'm looking for? Professional occupations that are buried in work as well. So I'd like to know who the people are that are actually entitled or able to find an ability to take time off.
Yeah, Owen, thank you so much for that. Because Charlie, Owen's right. Not every industry, especially as they're staffed now, can handle workers slowing down.
Absolutely. There's an inherent unfairness here that I write about in the piece, which is, you know, that a lot of this pertains to, you know, to knowledge work instead of, you know, frontline service work or healthcare work or care work in general. And there's a real inequity there. And as other people in certain industries take time off, the burden then shifts to a lot of these, you know, say hospitality industry, things like that, to, you know, ramp up to support that if a lot of people are going on vacations, say. So there is this real inequity there, and that's really true. You know, in our book and in our work, we are focused, you know, on a lot of knowledge work and office work, particularly. But I do think that there is something that we're seeing broadly with this, you know, this being fed up, which is, you know, part of this, you know, quote unquote worker shortage, right? You know, there's a lot of, you know, talking points that, you know, unemployment aid and unemployment insurance are keeping, you know, people from going out into the workforce. But you're also seeing on the other side that that as, you know, as wages rise from some of these businesses, they're getting many more applicants. So, you know, I think what's actually happening in general is even in service industries, there are people who are really fed up because they've had to work under, you know, these very difficult conditions, essentially hazard pay conditions. They've been, you know, lauded as essential employees, yet they're not treated that way with, you know, time off benefits, with wage increases, et cetera. And so there's this frustration mounting that is actually a little bit similar in some ways to the knowledge worker frustration. And I think broadly, generally speaking, this all comes back to what we talk about a lot in our forthcoming book, which is just a real resentment with, you know, the prominence of work in our lives, this notion that we must work so often and so hard and merge our identities with work almost completely, and that leaves, you know, that leaves out time for hobbies, for family life, for community, for volunteering, whatever it is. And I think that resentment is broadly spread. And the issue right now is that, you know, only a small group of people might actually be able to get that opportunity to recharge or reclaim their lives from work to some degree. And so it's a thorny problem that's not going to be easy to solve.
Yeah. Charlie, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Charlie Warzel writes Galaxy Brain, a newsletter about tech and culture, and he reports for The Washington Post. He previously wrote for The New York Times Opinion. He wrote about the summer slowdown in one of his recent newsletters. We've got a link to that posted at WPR.org/Central Time. Ahead, we've got an update on where we're at with self-driving cars and when we may be sharing the roads with them. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. The news is next here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 during the morning show, a survey of Wisconsin restaurant owners in April found that most places are dealing with lower revenues and higher costs in this pandemic. Hear from two restaurant owners and chefs about what the summer could hold. That's tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Now, in 2016, the president of the ride-sharing company Lyft predicted that in 5 years, driverless cars would account for the majority of Lyft rides. Well, here we are, just a few weeks removed from the company announcing it was selling its self-driving unit to Toyota. That came just months after its rival Uber sold its self-driving unit to the startup Aurora. Meanwhile, Tesla's been making headlines for the wrong reasons regarding its autopilot program. At least 4 people have been killed in crashes involving the self-driving system. And closer to home, an Illinois man was ticketed in Kenosha County for going 80 on Interstate 94 while asleep at the wheel. We're getting a status update on driverless cars, the challenges and the opportunities facing them, and whether everything people hoped will eventually come to fruition. Our guest is Michelle Krebs, the executive analyst for Cox Automotive and Auto Trader. Michelle, nice to have you with us again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We came across an opinion piece yesterday that said the dream of a truly driverless car is dead. That author wrote that the technology just isn't there and it's proving to be too costly. Where do you see us at with autonomous vehicles right now?
Well, they're out there. I wouldn't say it's dead by any stretch, and I think they eventually will be there. But as you point out, a few years ago, there was talk that we'd all be driving around or being driven around in automated vehicles. And if you look back at some of the wild projections of 4, 5, 6 years ago, they were pretty crazy. And that's not where we are now. So where we are right now, and the pandemic has had an impact. There are companies out there, Cruise Automation out in San Francisco, Waymo, the Google division, and a lot of automakers are working on automated vehicles. They're out on the streets of Phoenix. But what we are seeing is, indeed, this is a very expensive venture and without a payoff yet. So we are seeing consolidation in the industry, and we just aren't seeing them out there yet as robo-taxis as we were promised.
Who are some of the major automotive players still in the self-driving game?
Well, certainly Google's Waymo is ahead of everyone. They operate a kind of a robo-taxi system in Phoenix, but they've just had an exodus of about 6 of their top executives, including their CEO, and they're out trying to drum up another $4 billion to invest in commercializing the business. So I would say they are the leader. They've got a deal with Walmart where they transport things from a distribution center to stores, that kind of thing. So I would say they're ahead. General Motors has an investment in Cruise Automation, which also Honda has an investment in San Francisco. And they are pushing ahead. They are working on robo-taxi kinds of services in San Francisco initially. They feel that if you can do autonomous vehicles in San Francisco, you can do it anywhere. And then, of course, Ford is involved with Argo AI, which is a company in Pittsburgh, one of the early pioneers of autonomous driving. And Volkswagen is an investor of that. That's the other thing. In addition to seeing consolidation in the industry, we're seeing a lot of partnering because it's so expensive.
Hmm. Michelle Krebs is the executive analyst for Cox Automotive and Auto Trader. And we're talking about self-driving cars and whether they really are the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about driverless cars? Would you be comfortable riding in one, or do you need a human driver? What do you see as the biggest upsides or downsides to autonomous vehicles? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michelle, people interpret the term autonomous vehicle totally differently. What are we really talking about at this stage when we're discussing self-driving cars?
Well, the Society of Automotive Engineers has established different levels. So it goes from level zero, which is nothing is automated in terms of the driving, all the way to level five, which is fully autonomous, don't need a steering wheel, don't need a driver. We have vehicles that have level two, and we're approaching level three. Things like, so I test drove a Cadillac with the Cruise automation system, a system in it. So there are certain places that you can take your hands off the wheel and the car drives itself, but you have to keep your eyes alert. There's a camera that watches your eyes to make sure that you're looking at the road. And I believe that Tesla is putting that system back in its vehicles because there's been so many shenanigans with some of its drivers of Tesla putting on the autopilot and going
literally
to sleep,
sleeping.
Like one in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're just not there yet of, you know, eliminating the driver altogether and taking their eyes off the road.
Hmm. How far, though, has that self-driving technology come, though? I mean, to be able to take off your hands and have a car do something like parallel park for you is pretty revolutionary.
It is amazing. I mean, I think we can't. Yes, we aren't all the way to level five yet, but it is pretty amazing the work that has been done. And, you know, what we are starting to see now is instead of just jumping to a fully autonomous vehicle, we're seeing a lot of the work that's being done, the systems that are being developed, like you mentioned, parking itself, allowing people to take their hands off the wheel for in certain places. Those kinds of systems are gradually going into vehicles. And it's interesting, we did a study right after the fatal accident in Phoenix that involved an Uber hitting a woman walking a bicycle and killed her. It was horribly tragic, and people immediately were saying, I'm not going to drive an autonomous vehicle. But when we did a survey right after that, what we found is people who had experience, like on luxury cars, with some of these systems, not the full-blown level 5 autonomous, but some of the systems, they were much more comfortable because they'd driven them. They knew they worked. So, I think maybe it'll be a more gradual process.
We are talking about the state of self-driving cars with Michelle Krebs. She's the executive analyst for Cox Automotive and Auto Trader, and you're part of the conversation. You can call now at 800-642-1234. What do you think about autonomous vehicles? Are you nervous or excited, optimistic or fearful about the concept? Would you feel comfortable riding in a car that can drive itself? Or do you need a person? What about sharing the road with autonomous or semi-autonomous cars? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 here to hear your thoughts and answer your questions. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about self-driving vehicles. Tesla's autopilot system has been in the news lately, including for crashes that have killed people. One of them was in Southern California. And then in Kenosha County, a man was ticketed for going more than 80 miles an hour while he slept in the driver's seat. Michelle Krebs is our guest. She's the executive analyst for Cox Automotive and Auto Trader. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have? Give us a call. We've got Shauna in Milwaukee on the line. Hi, Shauna.
Hello. My comment is regarding, I have a dear friend of mine who has a history of epilepsy, and he's never been able to drive based on the condition of his disease. He'll never be able to drive. And so he's really looking forward to working out a lot of these kinks and bumps in the roads for automated vehicles. So that way he's able to rely on something besides public transportation. He goes to school for college in a more rural area. And so he does a lot of walking.
Oh, Shauna, thank you so much for raising that point. And Michelle, Shauna brings up this idea that a lot of people had, not just accessibility, but the idea that eventually we would not own cars, we would use these cars. What do you think about that?
Shauna raises a great point, because there are audiences that could greatly benefit from automated vehicles. People with physical challenges are definitely one of them. Think about the elderly, how they have to give up their driver's license but still want to get around. Those are really important audiences. So that is a good point. And the other thing I think, and you raise a good point, in that it may not be, and I think it's unlikely that'll be, that we'll have an automated vehicle sitting in our garage. I think the way we're going to acquire transportation differently in the future, autonomous or not. You may subscribe to a service where you have access to a vehicle. Maybe you have a subscription and you summon an automated vehicle, I don't know, through an app of some sort. There'll be something way more sophisticated than what we have now in the future, to be delivered to your home, take you where you want to go. And allow you a different assortment of vehicles. Maybe, it's a small vehicle to get to work, or it's a bigger vehicle to go somewhere with your family or friends. So I think we have to rethink how we acquire transportation going forward, because it's gotten so expensive. And, there are people who need it that can't afford to just buy that vehicle.
Yeah, leaves people out. We've got Peter from the Village of Summers who's given us a call at 800-642-1234. Good afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I just want to, my main question is this. Is one of the impediments for the arrival of autonomous vehicles the lack of a public private partnership. The roads that the government, state and federal, these roads are not being designed, as far as I can tell, with assisting the development of autonomous vehicles. For instance, in Japan, I see that they're already laying down new streets that have magnetic strips in them that were going to help guide driverless vehicles. So I guess my question is the lack of the public sector and private sector working together perhaps an impediment?
Peter, thanks for that question. Michelle, what about our infrastructure and how that plays into this conversation?
That is absolutely the perfect question. There are two things about government. We don't have laws in place for this. And there's a big push right now at the Biden administration to, allow more testing and put more of these on the road. But infrastructure is huge. And we can't even get infrastructure for electric vehicles yet. That's in the Biden proposal for charging stations and that kind of thing. And ideally, when we move to automated vehicles, we need a connectivity mechanism, 5G, whatever, so that not only can those vehicles talk to the infrastructure around them, but also to each other. So absolutely, that is a hindrance to adoption and to the ideal use of those vehicles.
Peter, thanks so much for that question. And you can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page if you'd like to weigh in or have a question there as we talk with Michelle Krebs. And Michelle, this is a little bit unfair, but I'd like you to break out your crystal ball, because we know that the predictions of 5 years ago, you've already said, were probably a little outlandish. Where do you see us in 5 years when it comes to autonomous vehicles?
I think we'll be, way ahead of where we are. But I think it'll look different than what we thought 5 years ago. I think we may see automated driving, for example, with trucks carrying loads. We will see them carrying goods. We saw a lot of that develop during COVID when people didn't want to share vehicles or ride hail, but they were used, like crews use them in San Francisco to deliver packages. Domino's Pizza has partnered with Nuro, a little autonomous vehicle company, to deliver pizzas up to the door. So I think that it's going to be used differently than I think we originally anticipated.
And do you think the demand will be there to incentivize these companies to keep going on development to try to reach that payoff?
Well, it certainly looks like there's Silicon Valley companies and there's willingness to put money into these ventures. But I do think it'll take more partnerships, between companies, as we're seeing right now, more consolidation. And it's definitely going to take some partnerships with government. The Chinese government is working closely with companies on automated vehicles. And I think that's probably what we're going to have to see in North America and Europe.
And is that a practical goal, to set aside the competition and work together?
Yes. And we're actually seeing a lot of that. I mean, Volkswagen and Ford are working together on electric vehicles and automated vehicles. Honda and General Motors are working together. There's a lot of that going on because everybody wants to get the same goal. We want zero emissions. We want, safer vehicles, which autonomous vehicles can promise. That's the promise of them further down the line. So there is that goal in mind, and they can approach it in different ways, even though they can work on the technology differently together.
All right. Well, it's certainly an evolving situation. Michelle, thank you for catching us up.
Thank you. Talking 5 years about it.
Sounds great. We'll put it on the calendar. Michelle Krebs is the executive analyst for Cox Automotive and Auto Trader. We talked with her about the status of autonomous vehicles and what the technology's future may look like. District attorneys play an extremely powerful role in the courts. These prosecutors have broad authority to decide whether to bring charges. But when they run for office every 4 years in Wisconsin, they often go unchallenged. Bridget Bowden has more about what this means for the justice system.
Kim Lawton didn't always want to go into criminal law. In fact, when she was in law school, she found it depressing.
I just saw the sadness of and I saw the brokenness of our system.
But after a few years of working in the legal system, she began to see potential for change. So she did something that few people do. She ran against the incumbent district attorney.
My husband and I basically just went out, knocked doors, and said, this is who I am, and this is what I would like to see.
Lawton was elected Bayfield County District Attorney in 2016, but her drive to hold one of Wisconsin's 71 DA seats is somewhat rare. In 2020, only 7 of these seats were contested. It's not a new phenomenon, and not surprising to most people who work in the legal field. It's a difficult job, with heavy scrutiny and lower pay prospects than working in private law. In rural parts of the state that are facing lawyer shortages, there may not be any qualified or interested candidates.
There's a disincentive to our experienced prosecutors to step up.
That's Dodge County DA Kurt Klomberg, president of the Wisconsin District Attorneys Association. He says one issue is how prosecutor salaries are set in Wisconsin. Elected district attorney salaries are based on county population, while assistant DA salaries are on a progression plan. So it's possible for ADAs to make more money than the prosecutors they work under. That's a problem, Klomberg says.
Assistant district attorneys don't want to step up and become district attorney because either they're going to take a pay cut, or for the majority of them, they're looking in their crystal ball and saying, by the time this next term is over, I'm going to be making more than that district attorney's.
The DA's Association, along with several other criminal justice-related agencies, have asked the legislature to address the problem in this year's budget process. They want district attorney salaries to be standardized across counties, set at the top of the range for ADAs. Klomberg thinks this will encourage more people to run for the position, and it will be a good thing for the system overall. In the state public defender's office, legislative liaison Adam Plotkin agrees.
It's always good when there are competitive elections. It forces issues to get talked about. It helps the electorate understand where a candidate may stand and what they might do if they're elected to office. When there's no contested race, those questions often aren't even asked.
The district attorney's decisions can directly affect incarceration rates and can make or break criminal justice reform efforts in areas like low-level drug offenses, treatment court programs, and parole and probation violations, according to reform advocates. David Liners is the state director for criminal justice reform group Wisdom. He says district attorneys have a huge amount of discretion.
The district attorney supplies a lot of judgment. They're going to decide what the charges are going to be, and they're going to decide how hard to come down on somebody or whether not to, whether to let things go.
In Bayfield County, District Attorney Kim Lawton has implemented a number of reforms, including a pre-charge diversion program for first-time offenders. Although she didn't start the program in her county, she supports the use of treatment courts as a way to shift focus onto more serious crimes. She often references a speech given by U.S. Attorney General Robert Jackson in the 1940s.
And one of my favorite lines is, "The citizen's safety lies in the prosecutor who tempers zeal with human kindness." And I think that's just remarkable. We do have to temper zeal with human kindness, both for victims and defendants. And I think that's the heart of prosecution.
Wisconsin's district attorneys will appear on the ballot again in 2024. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story was produced for WisConText, a collaboration between WPR and PBS Wisconsin. You can find out more at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, pollen can exacerbate COVID-19, and our changing climate means pollen season exposes people for longer stretches of time. We talk about how to limit our risk immediately and in the long term. Plus, it's that time of year where the birds are singing and the critters are frolicking and the ticks and the mosquitoes are biting. We've got an update on the situation with those pests. And a new digital collection includes hundreds of interviews with people in Wisconsin who fought in World War I or dealt with the war to end all wars here at home. We've got the director of the project who has details. And tomorrow, it's the week in Washington. We talk about what's happening in our nation's capital and how it makes a difference in our lives here in Wisconsin. You can hear those conversations and weigh in on Central Time. Join us tomorrow afternoon starting at 3 o'clock until 6, and that happens right here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening. I'm Keeley Boltina. owning a home can be a great experience. It can also be, well, a giant headache. A friend of mine recently closed on her first house, and I sent her a message that said, "Congratulations, you have a place to call your own and the responsibility of having to spend money on all of the stuff when it breaks." And stuff will break. Central Time producer Bill Martins can confirm that. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Keely. Yeah, check this out. So last week I was in the backyard trying to use the garden hose, but no water was coming out of it. So I checked all the connections, tried a different nozzle, tried no nozzle, still no water. Then I noticed a small stream of water trickling down the siding near the faucet and thought, oh, shoot, I really hope it's not coming in the basement. So I ran down there and found water coming out of the recessed light and the register and the ceiling. Everything was soaked, and I was worried it was going to cost a fortune to fix, but you know, we managed to dry everything out and replace the broken pipe for only about $30. So I think we got off pretty easy, but it was kind of scary.
Yeah, and a lot of cleanup from water. Bill, stay dry. Thanks for sharing your story with us.
Happy to do. Let's see you.
And what's your homeowner horror story? What went down? How did it end? Share it with us. Send an email to ideas@WPR.org to share your story with Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network.